instead of the edge, he would have been killed. But if luck had spared his own fate, not so with many of his battered soldiers. His face blackened with dirt, his body wet with sweat and matted with caked blood, his sword arm hacked up, he collected his remaining cavalry and drove them through the gathering darkness and the drenching rains to lick their wounds and scramble to safety. For 3 consecutive days, he pushed his men through pools of mud and more torrents of rain on all-night rides. Along the way, he was aggressive to the bitter end, ambushing a detachment of the 4th Union Cavalry, slaughtering them or taking more prisoners. Even now, Forrest was all hell for leather. Then, through more rain and thunder and lightning and mud, he defiantly retreated to the backwoods of Alabama, to Gainesville, safely nestled near the Mississippi state line. It was here he would regroup, catch his breath, hone his men, rest his horses, and plot his next move. It was around this time that he learned of Lincoln's assassination. What made Forrest so effective on the battlefield, and so suited to a prolonged guerrilla campaign if he chose it? The short answer is always the same, a gritty, prodigious military aptitude. But there is a longer answer, and as Forrest pondered his next steps, it now mattered. For one thing, he understood the coarse art of the psychology of war, the role of fear in battle, the role of psychological operations in combat, the role of rattling the opponent and keeping him rattled. Throughout history, from Alexander the Great to Napoleon, the generals who could employ these tactics often won. The generals who couldn't often didn't. Fear undermines morale, diminished morale breeds low-level panic, and panic fosters poor decisions. But of course, Forrest was a different kind of a general, fighting not with large armies, but commanding and shuffling smaller groups of men to disorient and disable a much larger adversary. 3 things enabled him to do this well. He knew how to make his command seem large, and in this case he played upon not just his adversary's calculations, but their battle-frayed emotions as well. He employed deception and skill, so he beat kettle drums constantly to mimic infantry in action. He lit and tended to fires spread over significant areas. He shuttled artillery back and forth from one distant point to another, and he dressed up his cavalry and paraded them as infantry. With astonishing clarity, he grasped the battle vagaries of space and time. How fast he could realistically move, and how fast his opponent was likely to move, enabling him to turn tactical risks into strategic opportunities. And perhaps most importantly, beyond his own implacable will and leadership ability, with which he relentlessly drove his men, asking them to be better, stronger, tougher, faster, and more fearless than they really were, he understood human nature, in his opponent's men as well as his own. Thus, he could calculate the shape of the enemy for any given battle and calibrate his actions accordingly. By the same token, he knew not just when to push his troops, but, just as importantly, when to let them rest, regroup, and replenish themselves. And of course, by April 1865, there were the intangibles. As the conflict in this war enlarged and grew, so, it seems, did his courage. He was intuitive, this much was sure, though intuition itself is often volatile, even rash. But he had gotten this far, and now, driven by an inner gyroscope, he was suited to the single-minded pursuit of his raw vision of battle, undiscouraged by rejection, defeat, or even the imminent prospect of death. These ingredients, then, which enabled him to fight the way he did, would have just as handily enabled him to make the adjustment to a prolonged guerrilla campaign for which he was so uniquely suited, should he only so decide. But would he? From the field in mid-April, Forrest looked like anything but a man who was ready to quit. In past weeks, he had been a whirlwind of activity, commanding firmly, "Spare no time. Be in readiness. Not a moment should be lost. We have no time to lose." He fought his own war against absenteeism. Some days earlier, he had a man and a boy executed for desertion, ordering their bodies to be laid on a well-traveled Confederate road beneath a prominently displayed sign that read, "Shot for Desertion." There was, of course, more strategizing. And he clearly relished more fight, issuing a rousing message on April 25 to his men. "It is the duty of every man to stand firm at his post and true to his colors. Your past services, your gallant and heroic conduct on many victorious fields, forbid the thought that you will ever ground your arms except with honor. Duty to your country, to yourselves, and the gallant dead who have fallen in this great struggle for liberty and independence, demand that every man should continue to do his whole duty. Be firm and unwavering, discharging promptly and faithfully every duty devolving upon you." These are the words of a man ready and willing to carry on the battle. But if Forrest was an unconventional rebel, he was not an uncontrollable renegade. Good generals, almost by definition, become political and institutional creatures, even ardent nonconformists like Nathan Bedford Forrest. Whatever their styles, they operate as part of an overall military ethos and a shared warrior structure. And, like careful politicians weighing difficult votes, they look to one another, if not for implicit guidance, then at least to gauge the sentiment of changing events and tough decisions. Much of this communication is tacit, unspoken, but it is no less real. It is a language of order and maneuver. And, as April 1865 progressed, just such an intricate, largely unspoken dialogue was taking place among a handful of men, less between the opposing sides of the Confederacy and the Union, and more among individual Confederate commanders themselves. As such, every bit as much as the formal civil military chain of command, it was now a handful of military men who were deciding the future actions of the Confederacy, the commanding generals of the Southern forces still at large. And in the weighty calculus of whether to resort to partisan warfare or to give up the game altogether, the actions of one general would profoundly affect the actions of the others, including of Forrest himself. Many thousands and tens of thousands of Confederates would then, in turn, follow their lead. But to a great extent, up to now, Forrest had been operating in a pronounced information vacuum, anxiously grabbing for scraps of intelligence any way he could. Unlike the North, where news traveled immediately over an extensive network of telegraph wires and quickly found its way into the next day's newspapers, much of the Confederacy was an isolated wasteland. The war had not only obliterated one quarter of the Confederacy's white men of military age and almost half of its livestock, destroyed a good 50% of the farm machinery, and left tens of thousands of small farms and sizable plantations alike buried under scraps, weeds, and utter ruin, but it had also mangled thousands of miles of railroads and just as many of its telegraph wires. The result was that the Confederacy was awash in gossip and rumor, but little hard fact. Lack of information was one problem, so was the misinformation. Thus, Forrest knew that Lincoln was dead, but he also believed that Grant had lost some 100,000 men through battle and desertion. He had conflicting reports about whether Lee actually had surrendered. Some Southern papers denied that he had, and believed he had not, and was now desperately trying to sort out the truth. He knew there was a flag of truce between his commanding superior, Department Commander General Richard Taylor, the son of U.S. President Zachary Taylor, and Union General Canby, as well as a similar truce between Generals Johnston and Sherman. But in neither case did he read this as a bid to surrender. Indeed, a number of Taylor's men themselves, even in their diminished condition, wanted to fight to the last. He also knew, or believed he knew, that Confederate General E. Kirby Smith was operating with a fairly free hand in the West, in the Trans-Mississippi Department. As to guerrilla warfare and taking to the hills, then, his strategy was now to wait and see, and later decide. Resist the sensational rumors and conflicting dispatches. he exhorted his men, instead counseling, "A few days will determine the truth or falsity of the reports now in circulation." Others, however, were looking to Forrest for just these purposes, alone or in combination with Johnston. After Appomattox, the prominent Baltimore journalist William Wilkins Glenn wrote, "Forrest has genius, popularity, and power. If these two armies, Forrest and Johnston, join and fall back to Texas, they could get 30,000 men who would be determined men across the Mississippi. An army of 50,000 men in Texas, with plenty of grass for horses and mountain ranges for defense, could work miracles." But before Forrest performed any miracles, he was waiting for definitive news of Lee and Grant. And one other man whom he would be watching just as carefully was General Joe Johnston in his discussions with Bill Sherman. Forrest couldn't have known it then, but in fact Johnston did want to surrender. Nor could he have known that, unlike at Appomattox, Johnston's delicate negotiations with Sherman would take on an astonishing life of their own, then go awry, and then potentially into dangerous disarray. Union General Bill Sherman, volatile, disheveled, irascible, was no ordinary warrior. He is now known for so many colorful exploits, as well as for being the first truly modern strategist in history, that too often we forget this. More than any other single Union figure, he was probably the most prescient man in the war. Confounding the predictions of the doubters and naysayers, the press and the public, and even of his own president. But in mid-April 1865, he had a new set of predictions, and a new set of fears. While in the halcyon early days of the North-South conflict, most of the Washington establishment expected something akin to a short, jolly little war, riding out to watch the Battle of Bull Run in their finest clothes, and jauntily dining in the hills above with their good silver and well-stocked picnic baskets, Sherman was suffering a near breakdown, believing he had too few troops to hold off the enemy. He rightly noted, this war would not end in 6 months, a heretical prediction for which the press labeled him crazy. By 1864, when most of the Union high command was still mired in traditional West Point tactics, it was Sherman who grew exasperated with playing the rebel game of attrition, fixing railroads, holding the roads, getting stung until it finally hurt, and fending off the likes of Nathan Bedford Forrest and his ilk. And he decided to abandon his supply lines in the middle of enemy territory, subsist entirely off hostile country, and begin his relentless march to the sea. Lincoln acceded to this audacious plan, but only reluctantly, and then suffered numerous anxious days and nights worrying about its wisdom. Where many still clung to the gallant notion of army versus army across the well-defined field of battle, Sherman shrewdly understood the deeper underlying dynamic of war, the critical role of morale. "If we can march a well-appointed army right through Confederate territory," he observed, "it is a demonstration to the world that we have a power which Davis cannot resist." Almost uniquely, he embraced and waged total war. War is cruelty, and you cannot refine it. And it was, of course, Sherman who knew what would eventually sap the Southern ability to resist, devastating not just the Southern factories, their railroads, their farms, their crown cities, but indeed their very will to fight. "We cannot change the hearts of those people of the South, but we can make war so terrible and make them so sick of war that generations would pass away before they would again appeal to it." Now, on April 10, after Appomattox but before Lincoln's assassination, Sherman had put aside his thoughts about a continuing military campaign in the Carolinas and was concentrating on how best to wrap up this war. On one hand, he believed the battle was all but won, but, as he later recalled, he was unable to shake his latest morbid fear of anarchy breaking out all over the land. Far more than the world knew, the Union was broke. In all its glory, the mighty Northern Armada was exhausted. Bankruptcy was a genuine concern, and the South itself, in no small measure due to his efforts, was a near wasteland and could be in peril of starving. It was against this troubled backdrop that he was convinced that Rebel Joe Johnston would take his some 22,000-man force, retreat rapidly to towns far and wide, from Hillsborough to Greensboro, Salisbury and Charlotte, and take refuge in the mountains of South Carolina and Georgia, breaking up his army into small bands and prolonging the war indefinitely. This, he knew, was what the Spaniards had done to Napoleon, and Sherman had little stomach for it happening here. Indeed, his own men had more than had enough. They were now exhausted. After nearly 4 years of hard fighting and marching, and the loss of some 30,000 of their comrades, they, too, were ready for peace on any terms. So were all of his officers who dreaded the thought of chasing Johnson's army out west and into the deep south. And, as it turned out, so was Sherman. It was little wonder, then, that he could scarcely contain his delight when he received a communique from Johnston on April 14, asking to meet with him to discuss terms of exterminating the existing war. He answered immediately, planning to meet with Johnston on Monday, April 17, midway between the picket lines of the two armies. At dawn's first light, before Sherman boarded his train, it was already shaping up to be a beautiful day. Clear, blustery, very bright, the chirping of birds muffled by the vast open skies. Cherry trees, too, were now in blossom. But the day's beauty was belied by the unexpected word of an urgent message, in code, from the War Department, racing down the coast by steamer. It had already been nearly 2 days in transit. Sherman delayed his train a half hour to receive it. The cipher message carried, of course, the news of Lincoln's death, word of the grave attack on Seward, and the dire intimations of a larger plot. Sherman immediately surveyed this disorderly scene and realized it could spell disaster. He promptly swore the telegraph operator to secrecy and told no one else. In his view, this was a calamitous event, less because of Lincoln's death per se, and more because of the havoc it could wreak on the country, plunging the North into a vengeful bloodbath against a prostrated and fearful South, which, in turn, would fight back the only way it knew how, with chaos, disorder, and continued violence. Under such circumstances, who knew what would ensue? To Sherman, it made it more, not less imperative, that he reach a prompt accommodation with Johnston. Sherman met up with Johnston shortly after 10, each man gently riding on horseback, and an instant link developed between them. On the surface, they couldn't have been more different. Sherman was a youngish 45, Johnston an older 53. Sherman was brusque, Johnston courtly. Sherman was tall, angular, and fiery, Johnston spare, graying, and methodical. One was an Ohioan, the other a Virginian. But beyond the differences, there were also compelling similarities. Both were West Point graduates. Sherman hated politicians and hated the abuses and calculating escapades of Washington insiders. Johnston feuded endlessly with Jefferson Davis. For all his aggressiveness, Sherman was no Grant or Lee, and contrary to popular belief, was actually quite reluctant to commit his men to all-out combat, preferring to fight with stealth and maneuver. Johnston, too, was excessively cautious, a defensive strategist unwilling to begin a battle until everything was just right, which was almost never, although he did give Sherman a decent thrashing at Kennesaw Mountain. What most knit these two generals together, however, was the 100-mile minuet they had danced across the no-man's land of battle over 3 brutal months, from early May 1864 to July. Without ever having laid eyes directly on each other, they more than knew one another, feeling the bonds of battle that ineluctably join soldiers' souls. Interestingly enough, there was also affection there, and real respect. And by now, both men had seen more than their share of war. As at Appomattox, Sherman let Johnston choose where they would talk. In this case, a small ramshackle roadside frame house belonging to a local farmer, James Bennett. Unlike at Appomattox, the two retired into the house alone, without aides, note takers, or the watchful eye of history, closing the doors tightly behind them. This was not yet a formal surrender, but, as it would turn out, a discussion, and then a negotiation, with its own dynamic and its own rhythm. On again, off again, it would end up taking 10.5 days. It began with some chit-chat about mutual acquaintances, but soon enough, Sherman broached the unavoidable subject of Lincoln's death. He thrust the sheet containing the information about Lincoln's assassination into Johnston's hand, commenting that it was bad news, the worst that had happened in a long time. "Great God," Johnston said, reading it, "terrible, the greatest possible calamity to the South." Johnston immediately denied that the Confederate government had anything to do with this horrible crime, denouncing it in even stronger language than did Sherman. As Johnston broke out into a sweat, heavy blots ran down his high, retreating forehead, Sherman believed him. Then they got down to business. While both agreed that every life now lost was murder, and that the resumption of fighting would be the highest possible crime, they quickly reached an impasse. In hindsight, it was inevitable. Sherman, under orders from Washington, rejected any proposal designed to lead to negotiations between the civil authorities. By contrast, Davis had consented to Johnston's meeting today only on that basis. So when Sherman offered to accept Johnston's surrender on identical terms as those given to Lee at Appomattox, Johnston demurred. Instead, he took an entirely different tack, pointing out that the time was opportune for closing the war across the board. "But that begged the question," Sherman asked. "What exactly did this mean?" Johnston led with a stunning suggestion, proposing that he and Sherman make one job of it, in effect, make the surrender universal and thereby settle the fate of all the armies to the Rio Grande. In short, end the war once and for all. Shocked, Sherman inquired if his authority was that broad. "It was," Johnston said, or at any rate it could be. He suggested that the Confederate Secretary of War, John Breckinridge, be brought into the mix. The rest of the Confederate armies would then follow. Taylor, Forrest, even Kirby Smith. Each would, to a man, obey his orders. Sherman brightened. This was, of course, attractive to him, and how couldn't it be? Every one of these Confederate generals was keeping his murderous gun barrels hot to the bitter end. If they could be subdued in one fell swoop, it would be a godsend for the country. But desirable as this was, Sherman said no. He couldn't deal with a member of the rebel cabinet, and in any case, Breckinridge was not just any ordinary rebel cabinet member. He was a former vice president of the United States under James Buchanan. But Johnston had an answer for that too, reminding Sherman that Breckinridge was also a major general and could be received on that basis. Intrigued, this time Sherman said yes. Over the course of 3 hours, they discussed the proposal at greater length. Finally, they were ready to break. Johnston now asked for several days to make all this happen. Sherman smartly gave him one. Neither yet realized that the following day would take an unexpected, even extraordinary turn, one that soon roiled both the Union capital and the remaining Confederate strongholds. They met again at the Little Bennett House, the same time on Tuesday. Rattling around in Sherman's brain was the vivid memory of Lincoln at City Point, just 3 weeks earlier. He could never forget it. Lincoln's haggard and careworn look, his concern for avoiding this last bloody battle, his resolve to get the men of the Confederate armies back to their homes, at work on their farms, and in their shops. As determined and innovative as he had been in war for his commander-in-chief, Sherman was also determined to honor Lincoln's memory and his departed president's wishes by being equally innovative in peace. Now, meeting with Johnston and Breckinridge, he got his chance. This time, the meeting began with a small ritual, not quite a toast, but an important symbol, a small gesture of friendship. Sherman offered them a drink, whiskey, and Breckinridge happily accepted. Then the negotiating started in earnest. Johnston and Breckinridge both agreed that slavery was dead. This was a good start. To Sherman, Breckinridge, once one of the United States' most talented politicians, at age 36 he was the youngest second-in-command in the country's history, was dazzling, citing every maxim and verse of international and constitutional law. At one point, Sherman pushed his chair back from the table and mumbled lightheartedly, "See here, gentlemen, who is doing this surrendering anyhow? If this thing goes on, you'll have me sending a letter of apology to Jeff Davis." But in actuality, the real icebreaker that most swayed the Union general was Johnston's heartfelt appeal to Sherman. Soldier to soldier, army officer to army officer, man to man, to understand his plight and the plight of the South. The truth was, Sherman had always been a bit of a tender romantic. This day, the moth could not resist the flame. Uncorking his bottle of whiskey again, Sherman sat down, gazed abstractly out the window, and set about composing a draft of terms to be given to the South. Finally, after scratching away for an undetermined time, he pushed the sheet of paper across the table. "That's the best I can do," he sighed. On the top was written simply, "Memorandum, or Basis of Agreement." It was anything but simple. As Johnston and Breckinridge read it, their jaws practically dropped. From their point of view, it was not just good, but far better than the terms that had been given to Lee. In 7 numbered paragraphs, it was, in effect, a comprehensive peace agreement, calling for all Confederate armies in existence to be disbanded and conducted to their state capitals, there to deposit their arms and public property in the state arsenals, for federal courts to be reestablished throughout the land, for the U.S. president to recognize existing state governments as soon as their officials took loyalty oaths to the Union, and for all citizens to be guaranteed their political rights and franchises as defined by their Constitution. In spirit and specifics, it was generous across the board. The terms were, however, conditional, subject to approval by the superior authorities on both sides. In the meantime, the present truce would be in existence. Upon reflection, the Bennett House meeting was an astonishing event, astonishing for a number of reasons. Where Appomattox was suffused with a kind of grandeur, this meeting had simplicity. Where Appomattox was a controlled, solemn event between two nearly mythical figures, as though scripted to the beat of drums and the blare of horns, and written for the ages, Bennett House was strikingly human in how it gradually folded and unfolded. And where Appomattox will forever be fixed in time, the drama and poignancy of every word and every gesture minutely recorded, much of what happened at Bennett House remains in question for us still. One of the participants did not give an extensive accounting, the other not a dispassionate one. But what is not in question was its ambition and scope. These two warrior generals had, in effect, sought to finish the work begun by Grant and Lee, and self-convened their own version of a mini-peace of Westphalia for no less than restoring and reuniting the United States. As dusk gathered, Sherman returned to Raleigh, North Carolina, convinced he had found a simple, forthright, comprehensive alternative to the beast of chaos and anarchy lurking around the corner. He wrote to the chief of staff of the army, "The point to which I attach most importance is that the disbursement and disbandment of these armies is done in such a manner as to prevent their breaking into guerrilla bands." For his part, Johnston's daring gambit, which sought an end run around Jefferson Davis's authority and the smoldering passions of those who wanted to continue this god-awful war, seemed to have worked. Mounting his horse, he retired into the darkening plain, to his battered and weary army, believing that at long last this war would soon be mercifully at an end. Within 5 days, both generals would find that they were sorely mistaken. For Sherman, with the best of intentions, it would become one of the most ill-advised days of his life. Back in Washington, all hell was about to break loose. In the Union capital, Sherman's memorandum was immediately met with a frosty reception. When it crossed his desk, President Johnson was enraged. So was Secretary of War Stanton. And that was just the start. At Grant's urging, the cabinet hurriedly convened at 8 p.m. on April 21 to consider the Sherman-Johnston peace terms. Grant also attended. The new president had already made post-inaugural statements lumping treason together with rape and murder as a crime that must be punished. To Johnson, then, this memorandum was heresy. For one thing, no military man had the right to decide political matters, and Sherman had clearly overstepped his authority. For another, there were the terms of the memorandum itself. In strongly suggesting that all Confederates would be exculpated from blame, they all but overrode the executive's authority to decide guilt or innocence of Confederate traitors, including those who had served in the central government. The memorandum was scarcely any better in the matter of the Negro issue. Not one of the 7 numbered paragraphs made mention of the fate of freed slaves. Worse still, the whole matter reeked, looking as though one of the country's top generals was seeking to end the war by reproducing the conditions that began it. Indeed, the provision that homeward-bound rebels would deposit their arms in state arsenals sounded conspicuously like a plan for keeping them ready and stacked for rebellion once the Confederates had time to rest themselves and then plot anew. As furious as Johnson was, the cabinet was even more stunned. Stanton was angriest of all. A whipping boy was demanded, and it would be Sherman. Stanton saw Sherman's memorandum as nothing less than a power grab for the Copperhead nomination for president in 3 years. To the chagrin of the more sober-minded of his colleagues, and hard to fathom today, he even feared that Sherman was preparing to march north and institute a military coup, reminiscent of the European intrigues carried out by both Napoleon and Napoleon III. Remarkably enough, Attorney General James Speed agreed. Actually, Speed was also frantic, expressing fears that at this very moment, Sherman, with his victorious legions, had immediate designs upon the government. Speed genuinely believed that Sherman was plotting to make himself a dictator, and he openly fretted over the recommendation that Grant be sent to talk with Sherman. Suppose, Speed warned, he, Sherman, should arrest Grant. Absent Lincoln's steadying influence, a ludicrous rumor even began that Sherman had been bribed in Confederate gold by Jefferson Davis, thus accounting for the generous treaty he had concluded with Johnston. Notably, this was not dismissed out of hand, not by the cabinet, nor by the Union at large. Rather, the story soon gained in strength and currency, even making its way into northern newspapers. In a staggering turn of events, the scent of conspiracy surrounding Lincoln's assassination that had ripped through Washington now seemed to have shifted from the Confederacy at large to Sherman himself. Such was the tenor of these late April days. The cabinet unanimously rejected the terms of the memorandum. As on the night of the assassination, it acted with unusual dispatch and firmness. Grant was ordered to take over Sherman's command and work out a new agreement to replace Sherman's terms. In the meantime, Sherman would be given the following order. The truce between his army and Johnston's would be immediately terminated, and hostilities would begin at the earliest possible moment. Without delay, Grant was dispatched to Raleigh to deal with Sherman in person. At Grant's insistence, the mission was to be conducted in secret. In the wake of Lincoln's murder, passions were already too high all across the board, and Grant also didn't want to embarrass his old friend, Bill Sherman. Still, Grant nursed his own private worries. He knew turmoil was gripping the capital, knew the North was tired of war, and knew the people were tired of debt. And most hideous of all for Grant was the prospect of Jefferson Davis safely ensconced in the Trans-Mississippi region, from where he could, in Grant's own words, set up a more contracted Confederacy and protract the war another year yet. That night, Grant left under the cover of darkness, at midnight, steaming away from the 6th Street Wharf. He would arrive 2 mornings later, on April 24. At first, Sherman would not be so easily pacified. When he got wind of his impending rebuke, he began pacing up and down the room of his command post like a caged lion. He let loose a furious stream of invective against his detractors. He called Stanton a mean, scheming, vindictive politician. He fulminated that his critics were not worth fighting for. And, notwithstanding Grant's efforts, the press had quickly learned of Sherman's actions. They were leaked by Stanton, which did not improve the matter. Indeed, it created such a stir that no other single event in the Civil War itself, outside of Lincoln's assassination, received so much comment in the papers. Now a blizzard of public criticism was unleashed against him. The New York Herald derided Sherman, saying that he had negotiated under a temporary absence of mind which unfitted him to deal with such shrewd tricksters. The New York Times twitted him as Johnston's outwitted opponent. Others were far more cutting. The Chicago Tribune accused him of treason, while the New Haven Journal insinuated that Sherman was an accomplice in the plot to assassinate Lincoln and had helped facilitate Davis's escape. And another newspaperman mocked him, saying, "What a contrast between the rashness of Sherman and the steady, never-failing equilibrium of Grant." But of all people, Grant was just the man to handle Sherman. Sherman had once remarked of his old friend, "Grant stood by me when I was crazy, and I stood by him when he was drunk, and now we stand by each other always." Grant did indeed. Smartly acting behind the scenes, he handled the matter with a deft touch, going out of his way to cushion the rebuke and to soften the embarrassment. Handing Sherman a copy of a War Department telegram that Grant had received in March while still in Petersburg, "You are not to decide, discuss, or confer upon any political question. Such questions the President holds in his own hands, and will submit them to no military conference or conventions." He explained the problem of recognizing existing local governments. Sherman understood, remarking dryly that he had wished someone had just sent him a copy of the March 3 letter at the time. "It would have saved a whole world of trouble," he morbidly announced, although the yeast of anger would continue to work on him. Sometime later, away from Grant, he privately exploded, "Why is it that every barroom loafer in New York could read in the morning journals official matter that was withheld from a general whose command extended from Kentucky to North Carolina?" But Sherman, while at times irreverent and scornful, was also ever the resolute soldier with a soldier's sense of responsibility. Like his colleagues, he had been well taught at West Point. Grant made his point, and Sherman got the message. Accustomed to adulation as the man who had captured Atlanta and cut a mighty swath to the sea, Sherman now had to endure slights that only weeks before would have been unthinkable. But rather than sulk, he acted, immediately sending a communique to Johnston notifying him that Washington had called off their agreement. In its place, he delivered a blunt new ultimatum. Hostilities would resume within 48 hours unless Johnston surrendered before that time on the same terms as were given General Lee at Appomattox on April 9. Lest there be any mistaken notions about his resolve, he added this stinging phrase, "Instant, purely, and simply." How much thought was given by the Union Cabinet to the Confederate reply? Or to Sherman's concern about the Confederates dissipating into organized guerrilla bands? Were Lincoln's guiding words at City Point recalled or even referenced? The record on this is incomplete, but it is safe to say that the Cabinet, like the Union populace at large, was now caught up in the blind fury over Lincoln's death. Lincoln's whole policy of mercy was seemingly unraveling. The record of the Confederate response, however, is unimpeachably clear. At his headquarters, Joe Johnston was dismayed. While Washington had vetoed this agreement, Jefferson Davis had actually approved it, largely because he anticipated, correctly, that the North never would. So this time, cradling Sherman's most recent demand, Johnston asked for further guidance, urgently wiring Breckinridge, "Have you instructions?" And back from the extant Confederate cabinet came the word that Johnston and Sherman had dreaded. The order was to fight on. The words must have rung in his ears over and over, "Fight on." Johnston was to take as many of his 22,000 to 25,000 men as possible and fall back to Georgia with his cavalry, his light guns, and as many infantry as could be mounted on spare horses. In short, what Lee had peremptorily rejected at Appomattox, Davis was now ordering Johnston to make come to pass, a guerrilla campaign. The order, indeed the present outcome, couldn't have been more disconcerting. Johnston's counterpart, Bill Sherman, perhaps displaying more enthusiasm than judgment, had just been severely rebuked for overstepping his bounds in his attempt to make peace with the remaining South. But had there been some method to his madness? The London Times had already warned of the Armageddon which now seems approaching. Suddenly injected into this volatile mix was now the very specter which Sherman had sought to avoid with his ambitious negotiations, that of Johnston's men taking to the hills. In turn, one must ask, had the Union cabinet potentially, if not unwittingly, played right into Davis's hands? Between them, the battle-hardened Confederates, Nathan Bedford Forrest, Richard Taylor, Kirby Smith, and also Jefferson Davis, along with Johnston, controlled upward of 100,000 to 175,000 steely soldiers, and each general was still throbbing with patriotic fever, prepared to battle on. Their followers, these filthy, bleeding, bruised, and tired men, were no less than their superiors, stalwart and hardy Confederates. United by a flickering national spirit, the Confederate colors were the threads still stitching them together. And unlike Lee's Army of Northern Virginia in its final days, while their morale may have been low and their situation may have been desperate, it was, they were not on the verge of starvation, nor were they surrounded. They had options. Until given the order, they refused to become little more than merely a disorderly or dispirited mob of refugees in their own country. One more thing. Many citizens of the Confederate States of America had heartily given up. As one Southern lady enthused defiantly on April 16, "What is it that sustains me? It is faith in the country, faith in the cause, an earnest belief that eventually we will yet conquer." The tinder was there, awaiting a spark. Could the whole process of reconciliation now unravel? It is at this point that a few men would take their places on the historic stage and tip the balance. Sherman's shadow would loom large as ever. From Richmond, Robert E. Lee would again make his voice heard. And for his part, Joe Johnston now had the weightiest decision of his life to make, one that would also prove fateful to the nation at large. Chapter 7. Surrender. It is late April of 1865. Across the battered landscape of the Confederacy, there are few poignant reminders of the pre-war days. At its best, the Confederacy has the look of a deserted fairground. But for the most part, the sights and colors are ugly, even ungodly. Here and there, dismembered corpses lie scattered about, their stinking, bloated remains eviscerated by rats and scavenger birds, their decaying flesh staring up at the stars at night. Where proud antebellum homes and mansions once stood, there is rotting wood and cracked paint and weed-choked grass. Where Southerners once took evening promenade walks down 100-foot-wide boulevards and through acres of rich green parks, there is the stench of urine and feces and decaying animal carcasses. And where there was once the clamor of commerce and exchange, there are now ghost towns and equally ghostly urban pockets. And, of course, there are the ubiquitous chimney stacks, themselves charred and lonely reminders of once thriving cities and bustling plantations. Yet against this backdrop of sorrow, there remains, still, the maddening cacophony of war, as small but deadly skirmishes continue. On April 22 alone, cavalries clashed once again in three separate states. In Munford Station, Alabama, in Hendersonville, North Carolina, and in Kansas by Fort Zara. Even now, from Texas to Florida to the Carolinas, bullets crack and ricochet, shells trill overhead, and gunpowder ignites and burns. And even with the Sherman-Johnston ceasefire, there is more death. The only way to appreciate the full magnitude of the South's wholesale devastation is to reverse the names. New York, burned to the ground. Boston, burned. Philadelphia, burned. Chicago, burned. Washington, burned. And Lexington and Concord, Massachusetts, and Rye, New York, and New Haven, Connecticut, and also Montclair, New Jersey, and Newport, Rhode Island, and Old Westbury, Long Island. Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, a veritable wasteland. Baltimore, Maryland, and Wilmington, Delaware, occupied. Fifth Avenue, barren. West Point, ransacked and torched. The New York Times and the Boston Globe and the Baltimore Sun shut down. And Princeton and Yale closed. Central Park, Manhattan, a national Confederate graveyard. Tiffany's, a burned-out shell. Niagara Falls, a blackened ruin. The New York City Public Library, trashed. Wall Street, worthless. And the list of those engulfed in the war, dead or wounded, or permanently disfigured by conflict, their careers tragically cut short, is seemingly endless. Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson and Henry James and Nathaniel Hawthorne, Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller, J. Pierpont Morgan and Samuel Gompers, Teddy Roosevelt and Thomas Alva Edison, Chester Arthur and Grover Cleveland, Andrew Mellon, Alexander Graham Bell, and Henry Ford, Adolph Oakes, P.T. Barnum, Frank Woolworth, and Albert Bierstadt. But of course, the names were Southern. Richmond, the Shenandoah, Atlanta, Vicksburg, Columbia, Charleston, Natchez, Nashville, New Orleans, Memphis, Milledgeville, Mobile, Montgomery. And those were only the beginning. So too, with the people. So many lives destroyed, a whole generation of men dead, dismembered, gone. A generation of women, widowed or forever unwed. A region foundering in confusion. Ruminating in his camp during these late April days, Joe Johnston knew that civilization in the South would have to be rebuilt, virtually from scratch. But before any rebuilding could begin, there would have to be a decision, to fight on or to give in. For some, Johnston understood the choice was agonizing. On one hand of the calculus would be honor, on the other hand would be these wretched scenes of a ravaged Confederacy. Could it survive more war, more reprisals, more insensate killing? And Johnston wondered if it could survive more Bill Sherman, who, as much as any other Union figure, cast a prominent and relentless presence over the final days of April 1865. For if he knew one thing, it was this. It was Bill Sherman who was responsible for much of the destruction of the South, and who would be responsible for whatever destruction was to come. Johnston was by no means mistaken. While it was Grant who initially ordered Sheridan to turn the Shenandoah into a barren wasteland, it was Sherman alone who first glimpsed the true meaning of the maelstrom of total war, that the enemy should be hit, and hit hard, in its ability and its will to fight, meaning that the target was not simply to be opposing armies, but the industrial potential and population that lay at the heart of the Confederacy. This entailed no more, and no less, than outright demoralization and devastation, if not the specter of extinction. In its very design and conception, this awesome strategy was, and even today remains, controversial. It meant attacking not just brigades, but villages, assaulting not just rebel armies, but rebel cities, creating not just outright death but long lines of starving refugees, hitting not just enemy soldiers but enemy livestock and food and private homes and plantations and shops and telegraph wires and railroads. It was terror, organized as well as disorganized, as much as warfare. And, for many Southerners, not since the glory days of the Roman Empire or the subsequent sacking of the Eternal City itself by the Visigoths in the year A.D. 410, which dimmed the lights of civilization for 40 generations, had war seemingly been waged by Westerners with such utter ruthlessness and with such a lack of restraint. Critics and ethicists today argue that his scorched-earth policies violated all the strictures of jus in bello, justice in warfare, a code carefully built up over a slow and painful 2,000 years of civilization. But Sherman was unapologetic. "War is cruelty," he blasted, "and you cannot refine it." So who was William Tecumseh Sherman? Actually, his first name was Tecumseh, after the Shawnee chieftain, and it was only years later, when he was baptized, that he was given the name William. For the most part, he was Cump, or Cumpy, and only in adulthood did he become William to associates, Bill to his friends. His men affectionately called him Uncle Billy. But to his southern victims, he was evil incarnate, truly a latter-day recreation of Attila the Hun, if not Satan himself. In truth, however, Sherman was an exceptionally alert, incisive, and intricate man. Though a graduate of West Point and the foster son of a prominent United States senator, who was also a cabinet member under two presidents, Sherman cared little for social decorum. Edgy and ill-tempered, he dressed in grubby, soiled uniforms. Tall and lanky, he was always thrusting his hands into his pockets or tugging on his mane of rough red hair. His face was furrowed, his hair uncombed, his nose jutting in crimson. More often than not, he looked as though he had just woken up. His manners were even worse than his clothes. But behind the rumpled facade was sheer iron, and he was everything his Union opponents said he was: excitable, incendiary, furious, volatile, and unrelenting. All this, of course, was part of his magic, and also part of his mystique. The word fits. Rarely does mystique come in one rational, linear package, and it would be futile to look for it in Sherman, who was always a delicate balance of opposing forces and conflicting impulses. He talked rapidly, in a high voice, about almost anything under the sun, but it was no idle rambling. He was at once charismatic, but also deliberative, big-hearted and warm, but also cool and gloomy, filled with grand ideas, but also meticulous in detail. And he was an asthmatic. His problem in life was not talent, he had an abundance of that, but temperament, and finding his niche. When President James Polk shook the world with the stunning announcement of a new discovery in California, ushering in the gold rush, Polk quoted, of all things, a memorandum written by Sherman. Sherman had a knack for being on the cutting edge, but he could never sit still or stay in one profession. In varying degrees, he had been successful as a soldier, a banker, an investment broker, and to a much lesser extent, as a lawyer, joining the bar at the late age of 37. But none of these professions captivated him. He quit the army, he soon tired of banking, and he quickly left the law. He had his share of failures. Then the Civil War began. There were few cues as to how he would perform. For one thing, unlike most other West Pointers, he saw no action in the Mexican War. In truth, he was untested in battle. For another thing, his personal life was inordinately complicated and filled with incongruities. The last of 11 children, 9-year-old Cump was given up by his debt-ridden mother to a neighbor, Thomas Ewing, when his father died. He was not quite an orphan then, but he was a foster child. Yet he became so much a part of his new family that when he proposed marriage to, of all people, his foster sister Ellen, one family member gasped, "Why, they can't!" They did, however. It took 8 years for Senator Ewing, his foster father, to approve the marriage. Nor was it just any ordinary wedding. Among the guests were President Taylor, his cabinet, and senatorial giants Daniel Webster and Henry Clay. This former foster child had become a child of privilege. Though he came from Ohio, Sherman loved the South and loved Southerners. While he had a Westerner's indifference to elegance in clothes, manners, and speech, he nonetheless adored the refinement of the Southern aristocracy. The 5 years he spent in Charleston were among the best of his life. He was as staunch a negrophobe as any Southerner, which is to say an inveterate racist by today's standards, and he despised the abolitionists with a fervor that matched that of any plantation owner. But in one crucial respect, he was different. What he loved even more than the South was the Union, a sentiment bequeathed to him by his adopted family. Thus, when the new Confederacy offered him a commission, he turned it down. Sherman almost didn't make it in the war. After 7 months of service as commander of the Union forces in Kentucky, he became so panicked by a rebel threat, which he grossly exaggerated, that he was relieved of command and hastily transferred to a backwater post in Missouri. The press labeled him crazy. But he did see combat at the First Battle of Bull Run, where he acquitted himself ably, and then at Shiloh, where he distinguished himself by fighting with grit and valor, surviving 2 minor wounds and 3 horses being shot out from under him. For the rest of the war, he was, in one manner or another, by U.S. Grant's side. When Grant became general-in-chief, he promptly made Sherman commander of the Western forces. Grant and Sherman. Their relationship was a complex and ambivalent one. In many respects, the two men were alike, creative in war, imaginative, perceptive. Both had fought off despair and failure. Sherman was deeply indebted to Grant, and more than that, saw in him a reassuring presence. "I knew wherever I was that you thought of me," he once wrote Grant, "and if I got in a tight place, you would come, if alive." But in one crucial way, theirs was also a tenuous thread. Sherman detested politicians and made no bones about it, and he despised the press even more, whereas Grant submerged his personal feelings and cleverly worked the system. Still, the two fed off each other brilliantly in war. And most brilliant of all was Sherman's bold plan proposed in the early fall of 1864, which Grant approved. For the Union, these were bleak times. Grant had been pummeled in battle after battle during the Wilderness Campaign and had now settled down to a maddening siege. The Northern peace movement was at a feverish high point, and it looked certain that Lincoln would lose the election to McClellan. Even defeat or capitulation seemed possible. Staunch Lincoln Republicans had begun to ask, why don't Grant and Sherman do something? In Grant's case, there was little he could do. He was locked in 9 months of grim trench warfare. Sherman, too, looked like he had temporarily stalled. But while the earlier battles of Vicksburg and Gettysburg were no doubt crucial turning points, no turning point was as crucial as what followed in this decisive election season of 1864, when Sherman proposed one of the boldest gambles in military history. The opposing Confederate Army, then under General John Bell Hood, had marched off toward Tennessee in the vain hope that Sherman would feel compelled to abandon Atlanta and come after it. Instead, Sherman basically thumbed his nose at convention and proposed doing the opposite, to ignore the enemy army altogether, head east, and savage the spirit of the South. Taking a page from Grant's Vicksburg campaign, he would abandon his supply line, cut off all communications with the North, and lead his some 62,000 men into the crown jewel of Atlanta, and from there to Savannah and the sea. "I can make the march and make Georgia howl," Sherman boomed to Grant. "I will cut a swath to the sea and divide the Confederacy in two." But first, He outfoxed Hood and took Atlanta on September 2, saving Lincoln and quite possibly the Union in the process. "Atlanta is ours," Sherman wired the president cheerfully, "and fairly won." But it was more than won. His soldiers had torched everything of military value, and much that wasn't of any military value as well. By the time his men began their march out of Atlanta, the city was battered beyond recognition. Sherman claimed to try to spare the citizens, but he could not, or would not, or refused to control his high-strung soldiers or the sociopathic bummers. Those desperados and looters lured to the march for the sheer taste of spoil. They slaughtered all the livestock they couldn't eat, ransacked silver and jewelry, and terrorized old men and helpless women. Next, they laid waste to many of their precious relics and molested slave women. And then they massacred able-bodied males. Even the city library and archives went up in flames for the sheer naked joy of it. Long lines of innocent civilians fled the city. Sherman had forcefully banned more than 1,500 non-combatants from Atlanta. Trembling, others followed. When his legions finally embarked toward the seacoast, Atlanta lay behind, a smoldering ruin. Diarist Mary Chestnut shuddered at what Sherman had wrought. "Since Atlanta, I have felt as if all were dead within me, forever," she wrote. "We are going to be wiped off the face of the earth." She was nearly right, for Atlanta was just the start. Sherman himself was unrepentant. "We are not only fighting hostile armies, but a hostile people, and must make old and young, rich and poor, feel the hard hand of war." That's exactly what happened. Sherman then ravaged Georgia, as far south as Savannah, paused, then lunged into South Carolina. Moving at a relentless pace of a dozen miles per day through the interior of Georgia, he laid waste to a vast corridor stretching 285 miles. Warehouses, bridges, barns, machine shops, depots, factories, farms, private homes, livestock, cotton, gin, and even slave cabins and their niggers all fell under a cloud of destruction and plunder. Sherman turned a blind eye to the thin line dividing barbaric ruin from the targets vital to winning the war. In December, more of the job was done. He sent another jaunty wire to Lincoln. "I beg to present you, as a Christmas gift, the city of Savannah." And then he commenced his most fearsome efforts yet, a second march through the heart of enemy territory into South Carolina. "The whole army is burning with an insatiable desire to wreak vengeance upon South Carolina," Sherman rumbled to Washington. "I almost tremble at her fate, but she deserves all that seems in store for her." And what was in store for her was out-and-out destruction, more intense and comprehensive than even in Georgia. The march, to total 425 miles altogether, began on January 3, 1865. Little of whatever stood in their way, whether the countryside or villages, remained standing after the army swept through. They burned towns and plantations en route, and magnificent towering live oaks for good measure. The path of ruin made the destruction of Georgia look like child's play. This was no longer war, it was sheer vengeance. Even some of Sherman's own men were shocked. "You have no idea how the women and children suffer here," one private wrote to his wife. But Sherman stopped at nothing to punish the state that had spawned the rebellion. In the rainiest winter in 20 years, his men confronted formidable terrain and weather. They had to cross 9 swollen rivers, make their way over scores of tributaries, slog through flat, dense, marshy swamps, evade alligators and snakes, ignore 28 days of cold rain, and skirmish with rebels day in and day out for 45 days running. A gloomy Joe Johnston stood in awe of Sherman's feat. "When I learned that Sherman's army was marching through the Sauk swamps, making its own corduroy roads at the rate of a dozen miles a day, I made up my mind that there had been no such army in existence since the days of Julius Caesar." but even Caesar himself might have wept at the spectacle that soon followed. Sherman's direct target this time was neither Charleston nor Augusta, as South Carolinians feared, but the capital of Columbia. On February 17, 1865, his units occupied the capital, and by next morning, the city was all rubble and ashes. Even for total war, the destruction was shocking. Sherman later distanced himself from the carnage, considered his greatest atrocity, by claiming that retreating rebels had started the blaze, and some thoughtful historians have agreed with him, partially at least, adding that he in fact did not burn Columbia,